Dr. Horn, the audio's off.
Recording.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, La Hunt Region. My name is Dr. Amy Horn. I live in Truckee, and I am the board chair. I want to thank folks from Fort Irwin and Indian Wells for coming to our meeting today. We welcome your comments and ideas and participation because they help us do a better job. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board. On the other side of our executive officer is Kimberly Cox from Hellendale. Down at this end, we have Don Jardine from Markleyville. Next to him is Keith Dias from Rosamond. Next to me is Peter Pumphrey from Bishop, our vice chair. And Eric Sandell is snowed in by the atmospheric river in Truckee, so he is unable to join us today. The executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. Ms. Kuyumjin, would you please introduce the staff?
Our staff with us here today are Kathy Odermatt, our board clerk. We have Kim Niemeyer, our legal counsel. Lori Kemper is our assistant executive officer. Scott Ferguson from our Tarawa office is our division manager. And Patrice Copeland from our Victorville office is here as well.
The regional board has a few items to consider during this meeting. Please feel free to comment on any item so that our decision will be based on all available information. If you wish to speak on an item, please fill out one of these orange forms which are on the back table when you come in the room, indicating which item you wish to speak on. And if you could print your name clearly enough that I can approximately correct pronounce your name correctly, I would appreciate that. It makes it easier. Also, please respect board members, staff, presenters, your fellow citizens. Everyone's views should be heard, and if a lot of people, although it doesn't look like a lot of people, are going to want to speak today, I may place time limits on presentations, but I doubt that'll be a problem today. If you have any written materials as part of the agenda item, please hand the copies to Kathy Odermatt sitting at the end of there, and she will distribute them to the board members. So that we can have an accurate administrative record, please speak after I call your name and come up to the lectern to speak. That's so that we can have a good recording of your comments. Please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. And with that, we'll go to the first item this morning, item number 11, which is public forum, in which anyone can address the board on any item that is not on the agenda related to water board authority. I have no speaker cards for public forum, so just making sure no one wants to speak in public forum. Hearing none, we will move on to item number 12. Which is an overview of the Fort Irwin Salt Nutrient Management Plan. Do we have a presentation for that item?
Yes.
All right. Good morning. good morning, Chair and members of the board. My name is Lori Kemper, and I'm the Assistant Executive Officer out of the South Lake Tahoe office. I am standing in for John Studi, who's been working on this project with Fort Irwin for a number of years. He is also caught up in 6 feet of snow in South Lake Tahoe, so he was unable to attend. He wanted to let you all know that he hadn't given up trying by the time I told him to abort his plans to head down through 95. So he's been very proud of working on this project as well. And I just want to let the board know that I had the opportunity to go to Fort Irwin this year to see the water treatment plant, and I was very impressed. So that's very exciting. So anyway, today we're very proud and thrilled to be at this point with Fort Irwin. where they have taken quite an innovative and proactive approach to salt nutrient management planning. And just to let you know, the reason that they started down this path was partly because of us working with them on their wastewater treatment facility and updating their permit where they had nitrate pollution occurring, and we were requiring enhanced and additional treatment so that they could reduce their nitrate loading to the groundwater in the Fort Irwin Basin. And they were also looking for opportunities to do more recycled wastewater use. So that began the process. When we revised that permit, that's when the board basically put a requirement on Fort Irwin to do a salt and nutrient management plan. So the state board's policy requires that salt nutrient management plans be created for pretty much every groundwater basin in the state, but it's in a policy. So what, and the only time we put it in permits is when we're bringing a permit to you. And that's what occurred several years ago with Fort Irwin. So they began down that path. And then because they were concerned about the sustainability of their groundwater resource, they also took the innovative approach to build a very high-tech system for water treatment for their drinking water that removes salts from their water and also things like arsenic and uranium and other materials that did not produce a safe drinking water supply. That was the system I got to see. So we've been working with our Division of Drinking Water folks collaboratively on that, coordinating. They were at the ribbon cutting. So today you're going to hear more about that from John Green, and we have reviewed the salt nutrient management plan and found that, you know, they've basically exceeded our expectations, which is very exciting in a very unique environment, and I'll let John talk more about that. And this salt nutrient management plan does cover three groundwater basins because Fort Irwin relies on groundwater from the Fort Irwin groundwater, the Irwin groundwater basin, and Bicycle, and I'm forgetting the third one, but you'll hear more about that later. So with that, I'm going to introduce our speakers, which is John Green, who's the project director from CH2M, and Steve Schultz. And then we also have Mohammed Bari that's here. He's the public works director for the installation at Fort Irwin, if you have any questions of either any of them. So with that, they will give you a presentation of the salt nutrient management plan, and we are recommending that you accept that and approve it. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm John Green, and I have Steve. Why don't you just go ahead and come up, because Steve Schultz is a hydrogeologist that helped us with our salt nutrient management plan. And first, I'd like to thank Lori and the Lahontan folks for their assistance, and obviously the board for taking the time this morning to hear about it. So Steve is actually the brains of the outfit, so I won't be talking a whole heck of a lot. I'll kind of open us and close us. Did you say this thing works? I'm not going to read the slides, everybody. I'll give you guys kind of the brief overview. I'll turn it over to Steve, and then I'll plan to close it, and obviously we'd entertain any questions that the board has. We're excited to be here. This has been a labor of love, frankly. So for those of you that don't know about Fort Irwin, is about 35 miles as the crow flies north of Barstow, California. It is the U.S. Army's premier desert warfare training center. The 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment is stationed there, so we have about something on the order of 12,000 to 15,000 permanent residents. Various groups from various branches of the Department of Defense come to train there. So our population can surge as high as 24,000 to 25,000 people on a daily basis. Fort Irwin has three basins. They're isolated basins, Bicycle, Irwin, and Langford. Yes, Langford. So, as you can imagine, we're in the Mojave Desert, so recharge is pretty limited. We get something on the order of an average rainfall amount of about 4 inches annually. So I think at this point I'll turn it over to Steve and let Steve go ahead and take us away.
I'm Steve Schultz. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you on this. So the drivers for the salt and nutrient management plan, really three drivers to do this. Number one, obviously, is the waste discharge requirement. It's required. But the other two drivers are water quality and water supply. So on the water supply side of things, as John mentioned, these are closed basins. There's no inflow, outflow. There's very little recharge. So Fort Irwin, the board, and CH2M are all very committed to try to extend the lifespan of those basins. On the water quality side, there has been some historical salt loading to the basin that, cutting to the chase, is now addressed with the new water plant that Ms. Kemper referred to. So a little bit about the water cycle here. So as John mentioned, there's the three groundwater basins. All of the water is used in the land area of one of the basins, Irwin Basin. So, and I'm going to show this graphically as well. In fact, maybe I'll just skip to the graphic here. It's a pretty detailed graphic. So let me, let's see. Do you guys have it on your screens there too? Or is it only a hard copy is great. Okay. So I'll point to this one so you can see where I'm referring to, but see about this pointer. So this is all Irwin Basin. So that's where all of the developed areas, all of the water use occurs within Irwin Basin. So we depicted it as sort of like this this reservoir of water, which it sort of acts as because there's not much recharge. There's also the Bicycle Basin and Langford Basin. So the three basins water form the water supply. All of the arrows on this represent the flow of water through the system. So you have about a little over 2,000 acre feet a year of demand, of water demand. And that demand goes to residential, commercial, as military uses, as well as irrigation uses. So all of the irrigation uses, that's the consumptive use of the water. So that water disappears from the system, but the salts do not. The indoor use returns to the wastewater plant, which is located within Irwin Basin, and then it's discharged to evaporation and percolation ponds, which recharge the Irwin Basin. So the historical water management issues have been really three issues. They can be categorized as: there's the water balance issue within the Irwin Basin. So historically, there's actually been more water going into Irwin Basin than is being pumped out. Again, because there's three supply sources, you're bringing all this water into Irwin Basin. Some of that, about half of that water, gets used consumptively. The rest goes back into the groundwater system. So there's been more recharge than discharge in Irwin Basin. Obviously, in the other basins, there's no recharge except for the natural recharge. So water's been coming out. The other primary issue, the driver for the salt nutrient management plan, is that when you're bringing this water in from the three other basins, you're bringing naturally occurring salt in. Of the consumptive use of the water, that's plants taking up the water and evaporation from the ponds, that does not take any of the salt out. So you basically have all this salt coming in, some water going out, but no salt going out. All of that salt had historically been accumulating in Irwin Basin. And that's represented by these images of the salt mounds here. So you can see there's a lot of salt coming in, percolation from the wastewater effluent, as well as from applied irrigation water. So the remedial action, which was proposed in this salt nutrient management plan, which the draft was in 2014, I believe, many of these things, in fact, I think all of them, are already occurring. So number one was the new water treatment plant, which, as has been mentioned previously, takes the salt and removes it. So going to this next figure, now you see where the previous figure had all this salt building up in the basin. Now you have all these salt mounds being discharged, evaporated, and being hauled out of the basin hauled away by truck and disposed of. So what was a cumulative loading of the basin with salt, with gradually increasing and increasing average concentrations in the basin, is now projected to be basically, we calculate a net salt removal, but only slight net salt removal. But what you can see is that the recharging water is actually of similar, the water that's recharging the groundwater now from deep percolation of irrigation as well as through the wastewater ponds is actually of similar or better quality than the background water. So that so I consider that probably the biggest remedial action because salt was the biggest issue. The second remedial action was increased nitrogen removal. I haven't talked about nitrogen yet, and we don't have the figures of nitrogen. It's a little bit different than salt. There's some of the same issues. There's naturally occurring nitrogen out there that gets pulled through the system, but it's different in that the primary source of nitrogen in the basin is what we refer to in the report as domestic nitrogen. So that's nitrogen added to the system, you know, effectively through human waste, and it gets removed at the wastewater treatment plant. So the wastewater treatment plant, the wastewater treatment historically has undergone a lot of upgrades and changes historically, and the most recent, just last year, was an upgrade to that so that the treatment plant is designed specifically to remove nitrogen. In the prior iteration, it was doing a pretty good job of removing nitrogen, but that was really, it wasn't designed to remove nitrogen. It was operated in a way that could remove nitrogen. And that resulted in inconsistent removal of nitrogen. Usually it was low, sometimes it spiked. And so moving forward, there's gonna be consistently low nitrogen coming out of the plant and recharging basin. So that one we're predicting with these changes, a very slight increase of concentrations of nitrogen on average in the basin. The recharging water is still slightly higher than the naturally occurring nitrogen, but it's well below the MCL. The recharging water, I think, is on the order of 4 milligrams per liter. And that's a very conservative assumption, assuming no nitrogen removal in the ponds where the water is discharged to. The third remedial action is increased recycled water use. And increased recycled water use serves several purposes. Number one, it promotes conservation in the basin. Just we have signs up that this is recycled water. Everyone helps everyone understand water is scarce in Fort Irwin and helps people to use less. Number two, that's less wastewater being discharged to the ponds and evaporating. So that cuts overall water use by something currently like 5% of reduction of consumptive water use. And number three, it reduces the need for raw water supply. So that can reduce the dependence of on Bicycle and Langford basins and thereby make them last longer into the future. Also, another remedial action to meet that need of making the basins last longer, the goal of sustainability, is to increase the pumping from the Irwin Basin. As I said previously, the Irwin Basin has historically had a net amount of recharge. Part of that was due to the water quality within the Irwin Basin. This new water plant can handle the Irwin Basin water quality much better. So Irwin Basin's now being pumped much more in balance with the recharge, further reducing the dependence on the other basins. And in the end, it amounts to about half of the pumping from the other basins, as has been occurring historically. And the final remedial action, again, with the goal of sustainability, is to install water meters. And that's an ongoing activity, and that'll help with water conservation. So the closing slide, then, is just summarizing sustainability and the board's and CHM's and Fort Irwin's joint commitment towards sustainability. Just to reiterate, the recycled water irrigation goes a long way towards that, as does the water metering. And in the end, that'll also result not only in greater sustainability of the water supply, but less pumping water through the system, saving energy and greenhouse gas production. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions on this plan.
I'm blinking. I just have to talk loud. so she could record.
Is it? Okay, it's off. Sorry, we have technical issues with our PA system here. So with that, Board Member Cox, do you have any questions?
Yeah, just a brief one. From the Bicycle and Langford basins, are you bringing water into the Irwin Basin from those basins?
Yes, that's correct.
So are those basins being depleted, or, you know, what's the production safe yield in those, and are you pumping in equivalent to the production safe yield?
The water is only pumped out of those two basins. Correct. So yes, they're being depleted now at a slower rate than they have been historically. There is no development or recharge in those basins, and very no man-made development or recharge, and there's very little natural recharge to those basins.
No current recharge. We are working with the U.S. Army Corps of Irwin to look at some projects. No current production, no current return. But we are working with our Army partners to look at projects whereby we can move some of the water that's currently being returned to the Irwin Basin to one or both of the other two basins.
I'm glad to see you're looking at that. While that's not the purview of this board, it is certainly obviously an important consideration in your water management strategy. Thank you.
Mr. Jardine, do you have any questions?
Yeah.
Mr. Dias?
Yes, but I don't have any.
I have a few questions. Very good presentation, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you.
This is a very complex system you've summarized for us. I also have some questions regarding sustainability of the water supplies itself, as did Ms. Cox. It appears that you're projected to recharge about 544 acre feet a year from the treated effluent ponds. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I'm sure you're making an effort to minimize evaporation from those ponds.
So, right. The answer is yes, to the greatest extent possible. Twofold. One, of course, has been water conservation throughout the installation, thereby cutting the amount of wastewater that has to be percolated. And then two, expanding the recycled water system so there's less water being percolated in the ponds, the least amount possible.
And that can actually be seen by comparing the historical to the projected. You can actually see that with the recycled water use, the evaporation gets cut almost by half, from 230 acre feet a year down to 135 acre feet a year.
Are there any things that you can do to increase the percolation and therefore minimize the evaporation?
Certainly, we're currently looking at, obviously the state has now began to permit direct injection. We have tertiary treatment, obviously, for Title 22. We are working with our Army partner to look longer term at additional infrastructure improvements that might allow us to do direct injection and thereby forego most, at least all the evaporation that's a result of the spreading ponds or percolation ponds.
I think I read in the background material that you're only seeing about, for natural recharge of these three basins, only 50 acre feet per year?
Yeah, that's a very rough estimate. When you get down that low, it's very difficult to measure that recharge. But yeah, it's certainly a low amount of natural recharge.
As large as Fort Irwin is, I would think that there might be some ways of capturing 4 inches of rainfall per year that would exceed 50 acre feet. And I'm sure you're looking at things like that.
No, and in fact, I'll tell you that in the last 2 or 3 years, there's been hundreds of million dollars spent at Fort Irwin, specifically installing detention facilities.
Some of the question I can answer.
Sure, please.
I'm Muhammad Bari. I'm the Director of Public Works. We have arrangement of the water system. CH2 is our privatized owner and provider, and we at the Army are the long-term planners on how to sustain. Our first sustainment measure is to conserve water. So since 2004, we have been able to reduce our water consumption by about 30%. And that is the major thing we are doing over here. The second thing is we have a long-term plan of putting some measures in the basins where we can start collecting the rainwater and percolating more instead of evaporation. So we have a long-term plan for that also. And at the same time, CH2ML is working on balancing the use of the water out of three basins, and we will study in the coming years how we can increase the retention of water in the Bike Lake and Langford Lake more than what we are doing it now. Because what has been historically we've been doing, we've been pumping for three basins and utilizing it for consumption. And then all the percolation from the wastewater goes into the urban basin. That is the current situation. But now we will be balancing because we have a state-of-the-art water treatment system. I invite the board members to come over there, visit, because that's a unique system. It is it has three treatment trains, per se. We do the EDR, and then byproduct of that goes to the RO water, and the byproduct of that goes to the mechanical evaporation. We are recovering 99% of the water. That is a very unique requirement we have put for Fort Irwin. We consider water as a commodity because the National Training Center is the premier center. We must continue training our soldiers over there.
As remote as you are, mm-hmm. I would imagine it would be prohibitively expensive to attempt to import any water.
Yes. We've been working as a team since 90s over there, and this is a collaboration effort of water board, water purveyors, and all those people that we have come to this stage where we have spent about $100 million to put this plant where the recovery was the main goal. Goal was not to just treat the water, it was to recover and recover maximum. So we are recovering about 99% plus out of this water system. So our, and on the consumption side, I can say we had about peak about 5 to 6 million gallons a day. Now we are at a 2.5 or $3 million peak at over there. So consumption we have cut down tremendously. Our wash rack systems, because we wash the military vehicles and those kind of things, all of those are on the closed loop recycling system. So we have invested ton of money, not because only we want to conserve water, we have to sustain our mission over there. That is the goal. And to we cannot sustain unless we have the natural resources. Water is the main water resource for us. The water, Army is very well aware of that, and we are considering that as a serious matter.
Yes, I'm convinced that you're using your water as wisely as possible. I'm just asking questions about possibly increasing the available supply. I noticed in the map on one of the slides that of the three basins where you extract groundwater, that there are some dry lakes.
Yes, sir.
Dry lakes are notorious for evaporating great quantities of water, but if the dry lakes are used by the Army as airfields, you probably have to maintain them. Is that correct?
Yes. Bicycle Lake Basin, we have a dirt runway over there. That's what we are maintaining also on the side of that basin. At the Bicycle Lake Basin, we have the dirt runway that we use for the training purposes. To tell you about how serious we are, we have been working with USGS since 1994. to study our basins. We have studied Irwin Basin, Bicycle Lake Basin, and Langford Lake Basin to the depth. We have done all the modeling we need to balance and conserve the water. I have a proposal right now in the works somewhere, invite people to, because we are also dependent on the best technology available. And what we are doing is we are asking to come do the study and see how we can retain the water in the basins. When in the desert, when it rains hard. Otherwise, it doesn't. So all the water flows. Right now, we have the water in Bike Lake Basin. We have water. And Langford Lake Basin, we have standing water right now. And we are looking for the maximum way to retain that water. And unless we're putting the cover on top of that, we are working on maybe, we will look into even the injection portion of that, that we can retain maximum of the water and retain and inject it in the basins. We will work with the water board and everybody.
I come from the Antelope Valley west of here, and that's the home of Edwards Air Force Base, which mm-hmm. is the lowest point in the basin.
Mm-hmm.
Edwards Air Force Base contains two major dry lakes, Roseman and Rogers.
Yes.
Any attempts by off-base water users to retain storm water are always met with objections by the Air Force because the floodwaters are necessary to maintain the mm-hmm. surfaces of the dry lakes. So I'm aware of that issue you're faced with.
In the last 5-6 years, we have studied over 10 basins within our Fort Irwin boundary. Fort Irwin is a 1,000 square mile area. It's bigger than the state of Rhode Island. It is a major training center. We have about 10, we studied 10 basins in that through with the USGS teaming up with them. And we have found some more of the resources, but again, they are very expensive to bring water to the installation at Irwin Basin. So our best effort is to retain whatever we can in these three basins and then balance and conserve.
Thank you very much. Good
You're
presentation.
Welcome, sir. You're welcome. And, but I want to officially thank the board and the water board team, La Junta Region at Victorville office, who has supported us. And this is the kind of support we need from to retain and continue our mission and supporting our military. Thank you.
Pleased to help.
Do you have any questions?
I do not have any questions, but I must say this is a very impressive piece of work.
I concur. It's really helpful. I looked at your charts in advance, and I was really struggling trying to figure out what's going on. So having you come and explain the whole system is, I've learned so much from your presentation, and I'm very impressed with what you're doing. I just had one simple question, which is, so does that mean that there are no septic systems within Fort Edward, and all the human waste is being run through the waste treatment plant?
The farther that the facilities that are not on the on the network and the wastewater and water supply system, we have some holding tanks, and then we have some septic areas also. But we are monitoring it very. We have a contractor who pumps them on the regular basis and dump into our own wastewater treatment plant and get treated.
Thank you. Do we have a comment card or? So this is Chris Woodruff for Fort Irwin. Do you want to make some comments?
We are working with CH Tomb Hill on a master plan to get rid of the few holding tanks that are close to the Cantonment area to make them go away. So we'll get more and more of that water, the wastewater, and get less of it potentially leaking into the ground or potentially contaminating our water source. But the nice thing about the $100 million water treatment plant is it's also a pump and treat plant.
Okay, I think with that, we will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the Fort Irwin Salt and Meat Treatment Plant.
No, we're just accepting it. We're not approving it.
Oh, thank you. So we will accept the salt nutrient management plan. So we do we need a vote, or we do need a vote? Okay. Would you call the roll of the board, please?
Ms. Cox?
Aye.
Mr. Dias?
Aye.
Mr. Jardine?
Aye.
Mr. Pumphrey?
Aye.
And Dr. Horn?
Aye.
Congratulations on an excellent work, you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought I'd have to bring the tank over here to get it accepted.
Hey, with that, we'll move on to item number 13, which is an overview of the Indian Wells Salt Nutrient Management Plan. We have a staff presentation.
All right. Good morning again. I'm Lori Kemper, Assistant Executive Officer of the Lahontan Water Board, and I am standing in for Dr. Bruce Warden, who is out of our South Lake Tahoe office, who also was not able to attend because of the snow. And before I go on to Indian Wells Valley, I just want to recognize Cindy Minton, who is in the audience, because you may have heard that she decided to retire. You know, things happen between Thanksgiving and Christmas time, and she made a decision that she would rather have more time to spend with her father at this point. And so she is no longer working for the Water Board, but as John Green and the folks from Fort Irwin mentioned, the Victorville staff, and just to give you, you know, an overview about what we're doing, you know, workload-wise, is that John had been assigned Fort Irwin and the wastewater issues there many years ago, and he was sort of assigned the salt nutrient management plan item. But he has since moved on to Northern California military installations, but he retained the salt nutrient management plan project. However, Alonzo Poach, who reports directly to Cindy Minton, is actually the contact at Fort Irwin for the cleanup of the other kinds of contaminants there, you know, from jet fuel and, or not necessarily jet fuel, but other solvents and things. So Cindy and Alonzo were very instrumental in overseeing the water treatment system design and permitting, because we permitted the drinking water treatment system because of all the removal of arsenic, similar to the permit you saw last night with Crystal Geyser, removing the arsenic and the salts that were permitting the tail end of that system, where the drinking water folks at Division of Drinking Water are permitting the, you know, supply of the water and the making sure that it meets those treatments. So anyway, I don't know if you want to say goodbye to Cindy or congratulations, but I wanted to recognize her in the office, in the room today. So with that, similarly with Indian Wells Valley, that's also located down in our South Lahontan region, but we've had Bruce Warden fill in to try to be involved in the efforts of the community there and many stakeholders. And today we have Tim Parker, who is with the Indian Wells Valley Water District. He's the consulting hydrologist. I have not spent a lot of time in Indian Wells Valley, and so I don't have the kind of connection I did. My day at Fort Irwin made a big difference. We're here today we're at the earlier stage in the plan development, so we're not asking you to accept the plan today. We're actually just asking you to hear a presentation from Tim Parker on their approach, and they're getting ready to complete some of their modeling on the different salt and nutrient loading into Indian Wells Valley, a much more complicated groundwater basin because of the types of water uses and land uses in that area, which is quite a bit more diverse than a single Army installation. So you'll be hearing from Tim about that. And as many people have mentioned, it's also in a situation where it's been identified as critically overdrafted groundwater basin, and the issues of water supply and water quality are coming to a head. So you will hear more from Tim on that. So far, what we've seen, the estimates, and they've done quite a bit of work, and they have a draft plan and scope of work. It appears that they will be able to manage their water and land use such that they won't cause nitrate to exceed the drinking water standards or the salt, so we are not planning to have to change our basin plan as part of this salt nutrient management plan, and we're hoping that you know, some innovative ideas come forward that help us manage that groundwater basin, and we'll be hearing more from them in the future. They plan to complete their modeling and the actual plan, and you know, we'll be back here in the fall for you to be considering acceptance. So they do have wastewater treatment, and they're producing recycled wastewater for golf course irrigation and water for the rare and endangered Mojave Tui Chub. They, as I mentioned before, critically overdrafted, so they have to address those issues under the new rules for groundwater sustainability. And as you can see, this graph shows these are groundwater elevation measurements, and this graph begins on the left-hand side of 1991. So this is showing groundwater levels dropping between 1991 and 2011, and the trend is not good.
So can you explain what the blue line on this graph? It didn't get into the
list. That was one of my questions. And Tim Parker, who's here, I don't know if he knows what that is either, because there's obviously the red and the green are identified as wells that are being measured at 300 feet deep and or at the elevation of 300 feet. I'm not, and so I think it's different parts of the valley, and the upper. My guess is based on the fact that the y-axis on the right-hand side is the actual water surface elevation, that these are three wells in different locations in the Indian Wells Valley.
Actually, it's a what we call a nested.
Come, you're gonna, Tim, sorry, you have to introduce yourself for the record. I'm sorry. So Tim Parker will address your question.
Right. I believe that actually has three different screened intervals in one well location, and one of the screened intervals isn't identified. I think that's what's going on with that, and I apologize for that, but I'll verify that and get back to you on it if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that would be sort of identifying your upper aquifer and lower aquifers. Water levels are, you know, we're shrinking both sort of groundwater aquifers. And here's a picture of the recycled wastewater being used on alfalfa this is also showing more innovative irrigation techniques that reduce evaporation, not the same as the drip drag that we see out at Hinckley Valley, but definitely better than some of the older techniques of irrigation. And then the other thing that many of us have seen driving on 395 is the increase in pistachios. And as you can see in the write-up, and you'll hear more from Tim, is that there is more of a nitrate loading from pistachio irrigation than there is from alfalfa. So it uses less water, but I think there's more nitrate that we have to deal with. So we'll be hearing more about that. And then if you have any questions, I ask that you ask Tim Parker them, because I'm not sure I'll be able to answer them. But as you can see, it's a new day in Indian Wells, obviously, with the giant pistachio there. So that's part of their future land, you know, current and future land uses. So with that, I invite Tim Parker to give you some more information about the Indian Wells Valley. All right, thank you.
I like that last picture, by the way.
I Bruce is really good at
Well, I guess I'll begin by saying that I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm actually here on behalf of Indian Wells Valley Water District, where I'm a contract hydrogeologist for them, and I'm also here on behalf of the City of Ridgecrest, who is jointly funding this salt nutrient management plan. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of metrics or background on the basin before I dive into the slides. About 600 square miles or 384,000 acres. And watershed recharge has been estimated in a number of different studies over the years at about 7,500 acre feet for the whole watershed. And there's about 26 to 27,000 acre feet of demand on the basin. And it's estimated to grow due to the pistachios that have gone in there have not matured yet. So that's one of the things that's been, that's kind of highlighted people and made it much more visible in terms of the water demand There's alfalfa, as you saw, and long-term alfalfa growing out there for decades. So it's there's a history there, and there's roots of an agriculture in the basin that's been there for a long time. And then the pistachios are more recent, the large-scale pistachios. There has been a number of small growers out there over the last decade or so. And so we have Indian Wells Valley Water District supplies about 8,000 acre feet. We have a appropriator, Searles Valley Minerals, who appropriates about a couple of thousand acre feet to an adjacent basin. And then the Navy, who's been just stellar in terms of conservation, they've conserved up to about 56% over the last 5 or 10 years. They've really brought their demand down. And I think they're at about 1,800 acre feet. And then there's a large rural residential population out there that have wells. And then the remainder of that is principally agriculture. So we're moving things along in terms of SGMA out there. I wanted to give you a little bit of background on that. It's basically there's seven partners, including the Navy and Bureau of Land Management, who are associated, non-voting members on a joint powers agreement that was formed by three counties, Inyo, San Bernardino, and Kern County, along with the City of Ridgecrest and Indian Wells Valley Water District. That happened a little over a year ago. And then we had our public hearing just this last December 8th to form the GSA. And the application's been filed. It's on the DWR website, meaning it's been accepted. So we expect to have a GSA. We're starting the process to start working as a GSA. We don't expect any overlap. We've contacted, I believe it's three different districts that are out there that aren't part of this, that have just a small portion in the basin. And that includes the Mojave Water Agency, who I see is here in the back. And they've indicated they're not interested in participating with this. And then there's it's Antelope Valley, AVEC, Antelope Valley, Kern, Eastern Kern, thank you, is one. And then there's another one, and I can't remember the name right now, but I can get back to you on that. Anyway, we've contacted those, and so we don't expect any overlap. And I guess...
So the deadline for filing for GSA is June 30th of this year, correct?
Right.
When do you hear that you are a GSA?
I believe it's 90 days after it's posted on the DWR website. I don't think you really hear anything. I think it's just that's what's in the statute, that you become the GSA formally. But you can start operating as a GSA, I think, as soon as you file. And so that's what they're doing. And so we have our next meeting's next week, next Thursday. And we're taking up bylaws, among some other things, and starting to move on getting an advisory committee going to work. So got a lot of work ahead of us, as you've heard. We've got a lot of challenges. So I think I'll move to the next slide with that if there aren't any other questions. Let's see. So how does this work? There we go. So a little background. A water level decline, as you saw in the hydrographs, that really started, you know, decades ago, but like back in the 50s, 60s, you know. So it's a desert basin, trying to change the equilibrium by increasing demand over recharge, you start seeing declines. And recognizing this, a cooperative group formed back in the mid-90s. And you can see the different groups that were part of that. They wanted to start sharing information, nothing more, sharing groundwater information, water information, telling each other what's going on. And so this continued. And then there were additional signatories, as you can see, including Bureau of Land Management, Kern County, and some of the agricultural growers, the major agricultural growers. Mojave Pistachio is one of them. Meadowbrook, who's also here in the room, and then Nugent Farms. Some of the objectives of this cooperative group are listed here. And so they wanted to limit large-scale pumping in areas that already are showing declines. You know, when you get declines, you know, they're in the areas where the most pumping is. So you get these depressions, and that's where you can start to see impacts of the shallower wells. So they wanted to spread that out. So they developed a water supply improvement plan. The district did was one of the things they did. And then they also distributed new groundwater extraction, and they're aggressively pursuing development and implementation of water conservation policy and education programs. And of course, we got help from the state on that with mandates. So there was good progress in that, and the district really had to work closely with the state board, because in a desert basin, one of the things that we have out there is we have swamp coolers that use a lot of water, so we have some constraints. And that may be something that we look at in the future in terms of trying to subsidize energy, because there's less energy, and it may be another way to kind of bring the water down. Exploring different types of water management programs, and I'm going to touch on a few of the studies as I talk through this, but this is an isolated basin. Reach outside is the LA Aqueduct runs along the west side of the basin. So over the years, there's been various discussions with LA DWP about a potential project, but nothing's really ever happened. And it would be politically a pretty heavy lift to move something that way. And so that's just one of the options, though, that's continued to be discussed because of the pretty large difference between what supply is in terms of recharge and the demand out there. As I mentioned, the WSIP, the Water Supply Improvement Plan, a model was developed in 2009 under a jointly funded project with many members of this cooperative group. Recently, the Navy updated that model. And they're working on, they updated it through 2015, now they're updating it through 2016, and we're going to use that to actually refine the salt nutrient management plan estimates and look at fate and transport, and also it'll be available to use in the development of a groundwater sustainability plan. There were a couple of AB 303 grant projects that were done over the years. One really helped to develop a refined hydrogeologic conceptual model, which was used as a foundation for the flow model, and the other was looking at the geochemistry and looking at age of water and flow paths and that kind of thing. So we've got a lot of good information as far as that goes. Currently, we're looking at a brackish water resources study, and this is kind of to extend things, but also look at how we can match the water quality to the user, and there's some potential opportunities for using brackish water out there. It's not going to help us on the water balance issue potentially, but it will also help us define how much actual fresh water there is in the basin. So it kind of helps us back out that. One of the things we're looking at is using aerial electromagnetics, SkyTEM, a Danish firm. There's been a couple of pilots. Actually, Fort Irwin had some SkyTEM done there. And it's being used internationally and nationally. USGS is using it. State Board recently used it in Kern County to look at some of the areas where there's brackish water related to the oil fields, and that whole issue with fracking and the injection wells that are completed in underground sources of drinking water, which has become problematic. There's also we're about to sign a contract with the USGS to do a basin characterization model, which is really just to look at historical rainfall and future climate and give us a better refined estimate of recharge in the basin, because as we move forward with the groundwater sustainability plan, we really need to sharpen our pencils on what we need to do out there. And so let's see, what do I have? So I already mentioned the JPA, and we're ready to start working on a groundwater sustainability plan in the coming months as soon as we get the committees up and running. and then we'll, of course, fold and or at least integrate the monitoring that comes out of this salt and nutrient management plan into that process. So as was mentioned, I'm here to talk about the SNMP. It was initiated by a Navy contractor in 2015 and provided to the regional board, and they found some areas that they wanted us to supplement, including salt and nutrient loading, assimilative capacity, and recycled water project areas, including rate charge and then anti-degradation analysis. It was really a preliminary attempt to get this thing moving. And the loading analysis was completed in the fall with stakeholder input. So we reached out to stakeholder in terms of the assumptions on nitrate use and applied water use. And the mixing model work is to begin in December. Actually, it began in December, and expect to complete that in the next few months. So, and I think you all know the purpose of the salt nutrient loading, and it's looking at irrigation water, and the potable water, recycled water, and groundwater, and then agricultural inputs out there, and residential inputs, including the septic systems. And I'll get into the details of that, as well as the wastewater treatment plants that are out there, the two plants. One's a larger one, and one's a, quite a small one. So one of the things, the starting point is land use clarification, classification, and it was divided into parcels based on county land use divisions, and parcels categorized into land use categories, and then these characteristics assigned to land use groups, and then we vetted these with stakeholders at a couple of the stakeholder meetings. The Cooperative Groundwater Management Group meets monthly, along with a technical advisory committee that meets monthly before the cooperative group. So those were the venues we used. And so we looked at the applied water, the percent irrigation, the applied nitrogen, applied total dissolved solids, and soil type as part of this loading model. And so here's the land use factors. And you can see the land use that's out there, where there was there's the potential for irrigated water. And when you look at that compared to the basin, the irrigated areas actually end up being about 4% of the overall basin, which is a pretty small number to begin with. And so they're broken up by urban residential. There's a golf course. There is alfalfa, pistachios, urban commercial industrial, and then urban commercial industrial with a low impervious surface. And so the loading analysis was done step by step, estimating the crop demand using crop ET and the regional effective ET for crop type. And then it was adjusted based on stakeholder input. And they calculated the applied water by adjusting for irrigation efficiency and leaching factor. And nitrogen fertilizer application based on crop type and, again, stakeholder input, and adjusted the nitrate uptake efficiency and the volatilization, and then applied a loading value, and that's pounds per acre year, to the land use distribution to calculate the total load on the basin. And here you can see by column the land use, the different land use groups that are were identified out there. And then we have the total acres, the percent of that that's cultivated, the applied acre in inches per acre year, and applied nitrogen, pounds per acre year, and then applied total dissolved solids, pound per acre year. And what you can see is the golf course is a pretty large one, and alfalfa is a relatively large one, along with the pistachios, and then you've got quite a bit of urbans that match right up there. Septic loading, that was another thing that we looked at. There's about 150 septic systems in the city of Ridgecrest, and about almost 2,700 outside, so quite a few septic systems. And those are associated with these rural residential houses. And for those, we assume 263 gallons per day, effluent based on 75 gallons per person and 3.5 people per household. And then 670 milligram per liter TDS based on the City of Ridgecrest wastewater treatment plant effluent, and 30 milligram per liter nitrogen based on typical wastewater concentration. So that went into the loading model. And then here on the wastewater treatment plants, as I mentioned, there's a small one that's Inyo Kern wastewater treatment plant. It's a small disadvantaged community. And then City of Ridgecrest, which was a much larger, it's like 30,000 people in that city. So you can see the different values that were used for the loading. And the locations are the green dots, the light green dots, the two light green dots. One of them's covered, and it's kind of almost in the middle of the diagram, and then the other one's off to the right, and it's in within the Seward area, which is the light green squares in the sort of middle right of the diagram. And then all those green dots are the septic systems, to give you an idea of the distribution. And here's the loading results. And so we have the land use groups again on the left, the total area acres, and then we break it out percent of the total area, and total TDS load in pounds by a land use group, and then the percentage of total TDS loading, and then the total nitrogen load by pounds, and the percentage of nitrogen loading. So that's a tabular mathematical result of that. Pretty exciting, huh? And then here's results of the TDS loading, again, by the land use group, so you get an idea of it. And you can see the TDS loading in the colors on the right on the map that show the distribution across the basin, and that's in pounds per acre year. And on the left, you can see the relative proportion in the pie chart. And you can see that alfalfa and pistachios and urban residential kind of have a close, although the alfalfa is a little lower, I'll point out. And then we have wastewater treatment plants as the darker color. And then for the nitrate loading, you see pistachios and septic are the largest proportions relatively. Pistachios being at 45% and septic being 36%, and then urban residential, followed by urban residential, and then the wastewater treatment plants. So that gives you, again, the distribution, and this time it's in nitrate. Nitrogen is nitrate in acres per year. Yes. Okay, so that runs through where we're at with loading, and we're starting to do the a mixing model to associate the loading with assimilative capacity, and expect that to get that done in the next couple of months. And we'll use the results from the loading analysis and mixing model to complete an end-of-digger analysis and collaborative develop best management practices with the stakeholders as warranted in the spring of 2017. So that completes the status. And I'm certainly open to any questions.
That's a great presentation. This is the only critically groundwater basin that's designated critical in our region.
Okay.
We have, I think, one other that's high or medium. But so unlike other regions, you are the only one we have. And so you are educating the board about the implications of SGMA on your water management. So this is great. And how complicated it all is. It's extremely complicated. Board Member Cox, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Horn. Going back to the slide, one of the slides that staff presented.
I don't think I have that up.
I think it's slide 14. On the Tuichup, I'm kind of curious about that. That is our only native fish in the Mojave Desert. There is a refugia here in Apple Valley and one in Cap Katy in Newberry Springs. So it's mentioned in here. I'm curious. I didn't know there were any in the Ridgecrest area. Can you educate me?
It's an interesting story. It was actually, I think, back in the 70s, the regional board and the then Department of Fish and Game decided that to do an experiment, is what I understand. And so they actually imported some tui chub, and they're living in sort of an irrigation type of ditch that receives seepage from some of the septic ponds. So it becomes a bit of an environmental issue moving forward. They're doing very well, thriving. I think what I hear is they're doing better than they are in other places. So it's they're not native, but they're there, and it's become an issue. Well, the city of Ridgecrest is undergoing a design for a new or modified wastewater treatment plant. And of course, that kind of limited what they could do with it. They decided they didn't want to disturb that environmentally. So here we are.
So do you know what the population is there?
No, I don't, but I can find out if you like.
Okay, and it's at the Ridgecrest Wastewater Plant?
Right.
Okay, thank you. That's really interesting, because there's other areas that I would like to see them reintroduced in the Mojave River, particularly in the transition zone by the Palisades. I was interested in hearing the pistachio. I had no idea, having been up 395 going northerly many times, I didn't realize there was such a proliferation in that area. Is this a new phenomena, or has this been going on for quite some time?
It's both. There's small growers that have been there for a number of years, and I don't know the exact numbers. Could be 10 years. I don't know. If you want an exact number, I could turn to some of our locals in the back of the room. But a more recent grower came in there just a couple, 3 years ago, and came in with a couple of thousand acres, which far exceeded the previous amounts. By an order of magnitude, close to an order of magnitude. So that was a recent thing. And I think, you know, this grower came over from the San Joaquin Valley, and where the water levels are falling quite quickly. And as you see from the graphs, the groundwater levels out there have been pretty consistently declining at about a foot a year. With this new pistachios, when they mature, there may be some areas that see 2 feet a year, is what the model's saying. So we're starting to look at that and what the potential impacts may be and where.
Well, and on the note of pistachios, when you look at your TDS loading and your nitrate, nitrogen, that's a significant contribution to the basin. Is that coming from the fertilizer used on those trees?
Yes.
Is there consideration of any alternatives so that you don't get that amount of loading? Because that's something you're going to have to deal with moving into the future.
I think that's possible, that we'll work through that in terms of looking at the different loading factors and work with the stakeholders to see what we can do to reduce the loading. But I think at the same time, I think the loading compared to the basin and distribution, we're not seeing that it's going to have a significant impact overall. So that's the other side of it.
So you are looking at that on a region-wide basis?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And then on your objectives of the cooperative groundwater management agreement, your first bullet point there is limiting additional large-scale pumping in the area. What's the proposed mechanism for that? Are you looking to adjudicate, or how will you be able to attain a required water use level to reach sustainability in this basin?
There's one thing that was done, and I think there was a lot of discussion when the pistachios came in, and Kern County went through a land use zoning process, and they actually took, to give you a little more background, back in the 70s, the way I heard it is that Kern County decided to make any open space that they could agriculture to bring more revenue in. And so there was quite a bit of agricultural land available to continue to expand. So more recently, they went through this zoning process, and they basically took all of the inactive agricultural land and changed it to some other zoning so that basically there's a cap in theory, on the amount of agriculture that can go in there now. So that's one thing that's been done. As far as the rest of it, you know, we've got a lot of work to do, and I don't really want to speculate on the kind of things we have to do, but we see the difference, and we're going to have an advisory group that's well-balanced, that includes agriculture, urban interests, the Navy, the Searles Valley Mineral, and everybody there at the table. So we'll talk through all the options, and we've got 20 years from when we adopt our plan to become sustainable. So we're going to be looking at the business and economic side as well as to how do we come up with solutions. We'll be continuing to look at surface water import as a possibility. We have to exhaust that as a possibility, so that we look at everything, including how much can we ratchet out of conservation in the desert, and how much can we do with that recycled water there. So we'll be looking, and stormwater recharge will be another one. This is another desert basin, though, and as was mentioned earlier, the storms come in flurries, and there's not many of them. Average rainfall's a few inches a year, and some years there's none. So not a lot of options there.
And I heard the population in Ridgecrest of about 30,000, but what is the overall population in this study area?
I think it's about 30,000. I mean, I'm not certain of that. I'd need to consult with somebody, but I can get back to you on that if you'd like exact figure.
Thank you for those answers.
Thank you. Board Member Jardine, do you have any questions? Mr. Dias.
Yes, thank you. Very good presentation, Mr. Park.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased with the progress you're making toward development of the salt and nutrient management plan. But I also have some questions, as did Ms. Cox, regarding the groundwater overdraft. You mentioned the formation of a GSA, and that you had contacted other agencies that might wish to be participants.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you said the Mojave Water Agency was not interested, correct?
Right. They said that, keep them informed, and you can refer to them, of course, but to keep them informed that they're not interested in being part of the GSA. But they certainly want to know if anything impacts the areas or any actions that we'll take or that sort of thing. So,
you also mentioned the Antelope Valley East Kern Water Agency,
right,
on which board I serve.
Right.
And what were the results that you heard from them?
Well, I think I spoke to an assistant general manager. I have to go back to my notes, but that they generally were not interested in being on the GSA for this valley because, again, it's a very small portion of the jurisdiction that extends into this basin.
Right. I would concur with that assessment, except that I don't believe our water agency's boundaries extend anywhere near Indian Wells Valley.
Well, according to a map from DWR, if you go online and look at their comprehensive map, there's just kind of a little finger that sticks into the very south end of the basin.
Okay.
Out near the Red Rock National Park there, the park.
Right, okay. Regarding the overdraft in the Indian Wells Valley Basin, have there been any signs of land subsidence?
Very good question. The Navy's actually looked at some NSAR data, and what they've seen is a couple of millimeters a year, so very little. So they're continuing to look at that, and we're going to end up, as part of the groundwater sustainability plan, coming up with some sort of a monitoring program for land subsidence. That may be since we're not seeing much, that may be as simple as doing some, benchmark surveying periodically in key areas where there's pumping. But, that's what we have heard from the Navy in terms of the NSAR evaluation they've done.
We've also seen subsidence in the Antelope Valley, which had been under severe overdraft for years. And in particular, it was Edwards Air Force Base that noticed the major impact. You mentioned one possible solution to the overdraft as being importation of surface water. Have there been any serious discussions on how that might occur?
I haven't been involved in those discussions, but over the last decade, apparently there have been some serious discussions with a few different organizations, including LADWP, and the Water District has also purchased some property in some different areas to, in theory, try to come up with a project. There was also discussion about potentially using a portion of the Indian Wells Valley Basin for a banking project. So there would be a shared water out of that, working with LADWP. But again, I haven't been part of those conversations, and I don't think they're ongoing right now, but it's certainly one of those things that we'll need to exhaust because people want to hear what our possibilities are before we start talking about ramping down. So,
did you mention that there was a land purchase?
Yeah, the district's bought some land in a few different areas. I don't have all those specifics, but outside the basin to try to come up with some different opportunities. So
has there also been discussion of importing groundwater?
I'm not so sure about that. I think maybe an exchange or something, but yeah, those are the kind of conversations we're going to have to start up again. Once we get going on the GSA and come, you know, the first step we see is, you know, having this recharge study done by the USGS to kind of have an unbiased, unrefutable, or to some degree unrefutable, recharge estimate, and then we can, go through the water budget analysis and look at what we need to do and what all the alternatives are. And then we have to start talking about, have the serious discussions about how we're going to get where we need to be in the next 20 to 30 years.
One last question. Based upon the maps that you showed on some of the slides, I couldn't tell if Searles Lake is within the Indian Wells Valley.
Oh, yeah, no, it's not. It's one basin to the east. So it's just to the east of the Indian Wells Valley Basin.
And yet Searles Valley Minerals is a member of the cooperative?
Yeah, they have been for years. They have a couple of wells in the basin and in the Indian Wells Valley, and they appropriate water, about 2,000 acre feet, to supply a community, a disadvantaged community, that is sort of the mineral company, mining company city there in Searles Valley. And they use that part of that water to supply the people, and a large portion actually goes to in situ extraction of potash.
Oh, you're talking about the community of Trona?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. No more questions.
Great. Thank you.
It's good. Very much.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
A few questions as well. I was wondering if, there have been sub-basins identified within your overall basin, and whether you have been able to characterize the water flows between those sub-basins and how they might be affected. That could be useful to you, perhaps, in figuring out your sustainable plan.
Yeah, that's a good, very good question. In fact, that's one of the reasons we're interested in looking in having airborne EM, electromagnetics. We don't have a pointer, but if you can see there's sort of a right half and a left half of the basin. And if you kind of draw a line, and it doesn't really matter where it is, because just don't think about it being exact. We see groundwater level contours kind of piling up there in the middle, suggesting either there's a stratigraphic control, but more likely a fault control. This basin occurs at the southeast corner of the Sierra Nevada mountain range. So one would logically expect to see some sort of, lots of faults, and there are quite a few faults in the basin. So that's one area that we think is really worth exploring, and we need to get more information to refine the flow model. Other areas, not so sure. It looks as though in the south part of the south portion of the basin, we may have a basically, you see a topographic high there that may be another potential split. We started talking about these things as we started forming the GSA, and with the timelines and everything, we decided not to move forward with any potential changes, but to the basin. But we'll be looking at these as part of the GSP in terms of both. Should it be one basin, or are there geologic boundaries that suggest it should be multiple basins, and or should we break this up into separate management areas, developing separate measurable objectives, thresholds for these areas, and undesirable results? So,
the only other question I have is, how do you see the relationship between the salt nutrient management plan and development of the groundwater sustainability plan? Because you're now designated critical, I believe that means the groundwater sustainability plan is due December 31st, 2020. Am I remembering the date correctly? Something like that.
It's January 31st, 2020.
2020, okay, earlier.
So we've got basically 3 years.
How do you see the relationship? I mean, it seems like we've got two different processes working on kind of different timescales, and how do they fit together from your perspective?
Well, one of the undesirable results is water quality degradation. So we use the salt nutrient management plan to help fill that, to evaluate what an undesirable result, how that would be defined in the basin, and to set measurable objectives and thresholds for that. So the salt nutrient management plan, the analysis goes into that actually tailors right into the groundwater sustainability plan. It'll be a tool, that's the way I look at it.
Those are all my questions. So we're not being asked to take any action on this. I think, do board members have any further direction or input to give on the next steps for the salt nutrient management plan? You have a big job ahead of you, really more having to do with SGMA than with the salt nutrient management plan, but I'm grateful if this exercise is useful to you in complying with SGMA.
Thank you, and we look forward to coming back again when we complete the plan, which hopefully will be in the first half of this year, and talking to the board more about where we are with SGMA.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we have completed most of our work, but just to give folks a chance to clear the room and other things, let's take a 10-minute break and complete the board business starting at 10 after 10. Oh, 5 after 10. I misspoke. 5 after 10.
Just for a tour. Yes. We just bought one. Buy me the. I'm like, thanks for, you know, Which is good and bad, because in some respects, like no. Well, any, if you want to voluntarily do it, right? And I've had this discussion with her,
we were there saying they could do it, maybe the April board meeting, because we were going to be meeting in Barstow in April.
Okay, yeah.
So we could do like the meeting the afternoon.
I know!
About six doors down. She had to blow the road. She was blowing the street.
down, and then another neighbor picked up and just hit the neighbor in the driveway.
Oh, you know? My God. Oh, that's...
In a Honda Pilot. Couldn't get down our road.
Oh. Well, we'll see.
And Ann Holden said her neighbor, there was three trucks stuck in her road yesterday. She was going nowhere fast. Yeah. Oh, so... I'm an escapee, Don. I'm flying to Phoenix today for the board meeting. I see my mom. She lives in the West. I'm not coming back. I'm not coming back.
Well, it's coming in next week.
Another storm.
Next Wednesday. Oh, yeah.
Another storm. I'm not flying. Oh,
you'll be right. Okay.
I think by then, I'll be a wall to snow. Yeah, no, it's been Kathy's going to fly today on that, so I just walk by myself, and then it's going to pop in, he's coming to support with it. I call him, I'm going to just go be the best. That's my brother, Susie. Okay.
It reminds me of, oh my God, he's a solid Democrat.
Yeah.
You know, I got asked to do the Central Committee.
Water. Yeah, no, I know. They probably.
Conversations are happening, but some people have planes. They're thinking about whether they're going to catch. So we can resume our conversations. Cindy, don't leave, please. I didn't get a chance to talk to you. We just have a few quick items, two quick items to finish up with, and then we'll be done. So the next item is item number 14, which is reports from board members. Ms. Cox, do you have anything to report?
Since I have to go first, Cindy, I just want to thank you. I think I've known you for 17 years. My involvement in, pardon me? EO report, okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, Cindy, I'm going to take this opportunity to thank you for your service and my decade and a half or more of interaction with you. Just thank you very much, and I wish you all the best. Now I'll turn it back over to the chair. So thank you.
Sorry, Cindy, if you don't want to sit through the board report, I understand.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, okay. We'll continue with the board reports. Mr. Jardine, do you have anything to report?
I do have to say. Testing? I'll be there. I do have to say that every board meeting I come to is quite the education. And that's about it. I'm looking forward to heading up the hill.
Just leave it on. Yeah. Mr.
Dyes. No report, thank you.
Two quick things. The 2017 Sierra Water Summit is scheduled right now for July 24 and 25 in Kings Beach. And the other report is that, to let you know, that the Eastern Sierra Land Trust has received an $8 million grant for a project, a five-year project, which is called Ranching in Harmony with Bi-State Sage-Grouse. And it's a grant to do all kinds of things in the bi-state sage-grouse habitat in Eastern California. Some of this money will be particularly available to ranchers in the Bridgeport Valley. And the ranchers from the valley were partners in the preparation of the project grant. It's really Eastern Sierra Land Trust is really acting on behalf of the bi-state working group. But it's really, this is very exciting. It was a highly competitive grant competition. I think there were 154 applicants for a pool of money, and it was unusual and unexpected to get funding for 80% of what was asked for in the midst of this competition. So we're pretty happy there. So just wanted to let you know that I think we'll be able to work with the Lahontan and other stakeholders on a lot of issues of water quality throughout, not just Bridgeport, but also where the birds are.
Very exciting project to hear about. Very exciting, and that they got the money. That's fabulous. So as far as my activities, I think board members are aware of my activities because I've been sending around an op-ed piece I got into the Sacramento Bee and an article that was written in the Tahoe Quarterly, which is taking a whole systems approach to looking at forest ecosystem restoration in our region and how that, and when you look at it at a landscape scale, there are multiple benefits, including enormous cost savings to the state of California. But it requires, the challenge is it requires all of us to work together and not get in each other's way, which is proving to be a huge problem. And along those lines, there's a collaborative, which perhaps we'll hear more about in the EO report, called Tahoe West, which is it's being run by TRPA, California Tahoe Conservancy, the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, and State Parks, one of the official people as well, partner. Staff is participating, the people involved, several people who are involved, approached me about being an active participant in this project, and of course it's very related to things that I'm interested in working on, but I told them that I could not be an active participant because the appropriate statements from Lahontan need to be coming from our executive officer and Doug Cushman, or anyone he designates to serve in his stead, and if I participated it would just confuse things too much. But because I'm interested, I said I was interested in staying informed about what goes on with Tahoe West. So the way that's resolved is Dorian Fougere, who is the facilitator, project manager of Tahoe West, is giving me monthly updates. And we've had a couple of meetings already. One was he was just explaining the Tahoe West project to me, and where we reached this way of accommodating both of our concerns about my involvement. And in that conversation, I realized that, again, as always happens, there are the two worlds that do conversation in the Tahoe Basin. There are the people who are concerned with land, and there are the people who are concerned with water. And the cross-fertilization between the two isn't as good as we would hope. And so I said to him, I said, I would like another time with you so to explain the Tahoe TMDL to you and all the work that's gone into that so that you understand the background and why people are so sensitive when they're before even Tahoe West Project has been, I mean, people even know what they're doing, there's talking about building new forest roads. I mean, all the money that's been invested in this lake and all, I mean, lifetimes of work invested in developing this TMDL, it's so people are very protective of it. So he and I have had that meeting. I wanted to spare Bob Larson having to do that piece with him. And so Dorian now has a much better appreciation of the TMDL, the work. I keep encouraging him to reach out to Jeremy and Environmental Incentives to see if there's they can there's anything that they can do to support the Tahoe West Project and lessons learned from developing the TMDL and how to kind of stage different parts. It's a very elaborate 3-year project, the Tahoe West thing. So it's huge. And anyway, that's just the resolution of that is that he and I are going to have regular updates, but I'm going to stay in the background. And I, you know, because this is my area of expertise, I will continue to do that even when I'm not the board chair, if that's okay with everybody else. Following our discussion on about climate change last night, I am hereby creating a subcommittee of board members to work with staff on developing that policy going forward. And that subcommittee consists of Mr. Pumphrey and myself. So we will engage with the staff in developing our climate change policy. And with that, that is board reports. Now we get to the executive officer's report.
Good morning, Dr. Horn, board members, our staff, and our one now new member of the public, Cindy Mitten. I'm going to update you on some things in our EO report, which is now 2 months' worth in your packet. And then Kathy Poole was going to give you a short update on the quarterly enforcement report. She, of course, like everyone else, is snowed in up there in Tahoe. And so Scott Ferguson will come forward on that. Speaking of snowed in, we are now day 3 of our office being closed. I am hopeful everyone in Tahoe can shovel out today and our office can be open for tomorrow. And people get their electricity back on and can warm up over there. One of the things I want to cover, which is in the EO report, is our staff report. We have 9 vacancies. Since I've been here, I think that Lori mentioned too, since she's been here, she hasn't seen that many vacancies at one time. So that's a lot of vacancies. And, so we are a little bit down on getting work out the door until we get things settled. We have 4 openings in Victorville and 5 in our Tahoe office. Most recently, Tom Sook, who handled our swamp program, was our senior in that environmental, has left state service. But good news, we just hired Kelly Huck to our swamp environmental scientist post. She moved. She was doing TMDL and base milk, and she just moved a little bit to the left or to the right and took a new position. So we'll be announcing for her slot. But we have a lot of opportunities, I think, for people and a few promotional opportunities for folks. I'm happy about that. In my EO report, I talked about the federal permit, and that's on bait stamps 15-30. This is actually kind of an innovative effort we're doing with Region 5, our neighbor, to oversee a permit that will cover federal facilities in our region and in Region 5. It'll be 2 separate permits, not one, but a sort of a parallel process where, to the extent feasible, we could see what aspects of what we do can be the same in both regions. We have different basin plans and obviously different boards, so it'll be a little bit different, but I think it really is a very innovative, efficient way that we're trying to do that. What it will cover are mostly the non-point source issues, like roads, timber, vegetative management, recreational off-road, grazing, illegal marijuana grows, fire suppression, cleanup, and, of course, restoration projects. It won't cover point sources such as mines or solar facilities. Those will be handled on a separate track, as we are today. Some key dates are that we're hoping to start the public process this year, reaching out to stakeholders, working with our federal partners. In 2018, working on the CEQA document, and if all goes well, in 2019, being able to both boards adopt something. I'm also coordinating with Region 1. They've asked to work with us because they have some aspects of what they're doing interested in this process, particularly the grazing, so I'll be meeting with them as well. We have a meeting coming up with the leadership of the U.S. Forest Service and BLM to seek their commitment and involvement of their staff to see this process through. But it's an innovative way of doing something. The board will get a full presentation in the month of March. You'll have staff come and give you a presentation with more details about what we're trying to do, what our timelines are, and what this might look like to get your input in the early stages as we begin in this formative process. Another item I'd like to mention in my EA report is the awards that both this board received and Bud Amorfini, who recently retired. So we have a nice write-up on Bates 15-33 regarding Bud and some of the accomplishments and the awards he has received in his career. Part of that I wanted to also mention is that the Lahontan Water Board received the Regional Forester Award, Leading in Public Service Environment. There's a nice picture of that beautiful glass and heavy, because I had to carry it a bit, award that we see was rather stunning. Jeff Marsalay from the Lake Tahoe Basin Management actually nominated us, nominated ourselves, Heavenly, and TRPA for the collaborative efforts we all did on the EPIC project at Heavenly. That was a very collaborative team effort, and he recognized us and nominated us. So it was a wonderful award to receive. It was very warm to get the well wishes from everyone. And Jeff Marsley has requested to come before the board to talk to you about that process. I'll schedule him in public form at some point, and I'll bring the award to our next meeting so you can actually see it. Another item I want to highlight is the Bridgeport waiver and the collaborative meetings we're having with the BRO. The next one is January 18th in Gardnerville, and Board Member Pete Pumphrey has kindly agreed, to weather permitting, to perhaps attend that meeting. And we have another one January 31st in South Lake Tahoe, with the goal of, again, in March, coming to the board with the BRO and UC Davis and staff, kind of present to you our framework of the idea that we're hoping to think of doing, and seeing to get the board's input and guidance going forward. The first meeting was well attended in Gardnerville by, it seemed like, 30-ish people, as I recall, a lot of them ranchers who had traveled, about this concept of doing a watershed-based approach to dealing with not just the grazing problems in the Bridgeport Valley, but to improve the streams and to improve the reservoir. And so we're in the very infantile baby step stages where the BRO is seeking funding to do some planning. So you will likely see a parallel process that while we explore a watershed-based approach, you will still have to have the waiver or some version of it renewed, you know, sort of parallel path until the other approach can be formulated better. But everyone was very positive. I think the ranchers and the staff, I can certainly speak for staff, were very excited about this more innovative approach to solving our water quality problems and at the same time helping the reservoir. So stay tuned for more information in March. Dr. Horn mentioned Lake Tahoe West, and there's a write-up on page 15-35 about that effort that I encourage you to read. You'll start seeing regular updates in my EA report on Lake Tahoe West. That also, I'm very excited, as you know, our staff are very involved in this, of the collaborative effort that holds for our region. I'm hoping that effort which, you know, as Dr. Horn mentioned, the government agencies, and we also have a lot of partner agencies helping with that. We are one of those, since we will ultimately have to issue permits at some part of the process. You know, it's a team effort, and Doug Cushman is our lead on that. We have other staff participating at times. But it really is a huge goal and a huge opportunity to have discussions about fuels management, healthy forests, restoration in one effort. At one point, they had talked about going over the crest to Region 5 and incorporating them, but I think it's a lot. So I think they're focused now to stay within the basin. And we, you know, their big goals are to assess the landscape and identify restoration priorities, to develop multi-jurisdictional strategies for covering this large land base, over 80,000 acres, plan a series of projects, get them permitted, and then monitor and improve on projects over time to have sort of a check on how are we doing? Are we improving the environment as a whole? So it really is a very innovative approach. And I'm glad Dr. Horn is lending her forestry expertise and knowledge to the effort, and staff are being involved as well. Barstow perchlorate, you may have seen the press release that we did recently. Very excited that we received the money from the state board and very grateful for that. And Cindy Mitten had a key part in ensuring that that got done. So thank you, Cindy, and your staff on that. And I think we really are excited about helping the community and helping those residents improve the area. I talked to Kurt Mitchell. He was very appreciative of the efforts, the general manager of Barstow, and more to come. We will have to come back at a later date and maybe ask for more money from the state board, but that's a couple of years out. I have a new attachment in your packet on bait stamp 15-61 that you'll start seeing on a regular basis. It took me a while to get this going, but what it is, you had asked me previously, so what are the things that you were delegated, like NOAs and other things, that you sign on behalf of the board? So that list on Bates 15-61 is an example of that. And you'll start seeing that every month now in your packet. So I want to draw your attention. We do have a minor typo. So I apologize for that we are fixing on the Lake Gregory Sediment Management. It's not a bioregulation project. It's actually a bioretention project. But that concludes my report on the year. There's a lot of information in there, and I'm open to any questions you have on that. If you have any questions on any of the items in there.
Have any questions?
None on this, but I will be on the invitation for everyone.
Wonderful. I'd be happy to do that.
Sorry, Ms. Cox, can you repeat that question into the microphone? Sorry.
I'd like for us to schedule a tour of the Fort Irwin wastewater treatment facility and water treatment facility at the invitation granted to us today.
Maybe I'd be happy to do that.
Before yes. Down here would be a good time of year before it gets really hot out there.
Thank you. Be April.
Yeah, I'd like to also go to Fort Irwin. We talked briefly about it, but sounds like cutting edge actions out there. And that's it for me. Thank you. It's quite a report.
The Fort Irwin facilities would be wonderful. Thank you.
Done making my notes yet. Scott, I wanted to thank you very much for the lovely write-up about Bud Amorfini and the EO report. Yeah, that was very nicely done and very richly.
Yeah.
I was sorry to see that Tom Gavigan left us. He had, and we had just a Superior Accomplishment Award to, and
yeah.
He has left our staff and gone to the Central Valley staff, which yes. is a great loss for us.
Indeed.
So I just wanted to mention that. Congratulations on the Barstow money. That's fabulous. I wanted to ask you some questions about item number 8, the Upper Truckee River Reach Restoration Project. If you could speak a little bit. So are we considering taking enforcement action against this? I mean, this seems pretty egregious that they fell behind. They're not taking our October 15th. The Basin Management Unit apparently does not take our October 15th deadline seriously. They fell several weeks behind in schedule. They didn't have enough fill material. Erosion called. There were design problems. They didn't account for all the storm drainage, outfall culverts, or historic channels. I mean, there's a serious plug of sediment that went into the lake because of their failures. And it seems to me this is something that enforcement action should be considered.
And just to clarify, there were two rain events. So the first rain event was a rather extreme event, and staff reviewed it and determined not to take enforcement action at that time, but to work collaboratively with LTBMU to work on fixing what they had done. And so they have submitted, you know, that we've asked them to submit a short-term and a long-term plan. I did give an extension on the long-term plan to fix it. You're correct, Dr. Horn. Some of it was they didn't get it done in time. Some of it was out of their control because of the extreme weather event. The second incident, staff are still looking into potential enforcement action, and they have not, I think, completed their review to determine that. They were waiting for some more information, and that's probably as much as I could probably say about that, since it could go to the enforcement side of the equation. There's a lot of lessons learned from this that we're going to have. We are going to have a lessons learned meeting scheduled with LTBMU going forward on not just this restoration, but any future restorations that they're planning in Tahoe West, for example, to ensure that we have a better system. Some of the lessons learned, we as staff have realized that, you know, we've traditionally let the construction season go into October, but you know, maybe there are earlier deadlines that if they're not going to get done by then, you know, we have to, as part of climate change, revisit how long we let construction go into those areas with extreme weather events. Other ideas we've mulled as staff are, you know, maybe there's a contingency plan that needs to be part of this. If you're starting to get close to where you are vulnerable to extreme weather events, you probably should have a contingency plan as part of your permitting process or part of any extension that, in case something happens, that they can react to it. So I agree with you, Dr. Horn. Staff are looking at this very carefully about what to do with this particular site and this particular incident in LTBMU, as well as what we do in the future. I can tell you that Jeff Marsolet, who is taking this very seriously, I think he feels uncomfortable that they didn't get it buttoned up in time, that it didn't, before the rains hit, that it didn't get buttoned up into the area, the quality that it should have been. And so he is bending over backwards in his staff to get everything fixed as best they can. You know, they did the best they could this winter until the snow dropped. And that may mean in spring, they're likely going to mean in spring or later when it's a little drier, when they can get out, they're going to have to do some other projects. And we'll know better, you know, when the area is dry next year and the water is down, what we need to do to further secure that area. But we're all taking this very seriously.
And in general, the improved relationship between the law and board and Basin Management Unit is really terrific. And of course, I'm in favor of working collaboratively with our sister agencies as much as possible. it's just like when does it become codependent behavior that we continue to, you know, say, do better next time. We won't bring enforcement action against you this time, but we want you to do better next time. And then the next time comes and again, things go wrong. And we just can't keep doing that, particularly when something is so egregious as this. I mean, I understand, I mean, that the basin management, the different sections of the basin management unit, different components within the basin management unit aren't always on the same page with each other. And that's a big part of what's contributing to this problem. But the supervisor is ultimately responsible for the cohesive work of his staff. And he needs to be held accountable. And to make that happen, this is very serious. This is a $2 billion investment. And, you know, I mean, in my time on the board, I've just seen a lot of pushback from the basin management unit and not taking our policy seriously. And at some point, you know, we have to draw a line. And I don't know, I mean, of course, this is up to you to decide what you think, propose what, how to go forward. But at some point, I'm just wondering whether this is one of those times.
No, I guess I'm more hopeful because I received some verbal commitments from the supervisor. I'll just be frank. The discussion I had was that your restoration projects, not just this one, other ones, have been C-minus and some of them D. Plus work. We need A-plus work. Shout out to the Conservancy who does A-plus work. And so part of this short-term and long-term plan we're going to get will help us get there. The lessons learned will be the important discussion going forward. Jeff has committed to me. From this point on, he commits to doing A-plus work. So part of our lessons learned will be cementing or writing down in an assurance of what they're going to be doing in the future to ensure A-plus work. So I do. I feel confident, Dr. Horn, because I got a personal and very heartfelt commitment from the supervisor about A-plus work going forward.
All along, as we were developing the TMDL, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of the public were saying, why are you coming down so hard on South Lake Tahoe and El Dorado County and Placer County and not putting similar requirements on the basin management unit and CTC, et cetera, you know, the places that are not part of the urban area. And it just, you know, this kind of exacerbates the appearance that we're not being even handed in how we're regulating the different entities that operate within the basin. So it's politically sensitive, I think.
No, I think we're very well of the, and we've been talking to our local government partners about it. But this is a restoration project, and some of it was outside of their control. It's an extreme weather part of it, so. It was a series of unfortunate events.
We've heard that before, though.
Yes, we have, but I have a commitment on doing better, so I'll report back to the board. When we have our lessons learned and a path forward, we'll report back to the board on that.
Okay.
Maybe I'll ask Jeff to come here with me on that.
Okay, that might be a good thing to consider. I had a question about item number 12, the Lake Tahoe Marina Owners Meeting. I mean, so we just recently adopted a new marinas permit. I don't recall, and maybe it just passed by me, that part of that permit included mandatory minimum penalties for stormwater runoff. And is that something we were required to do, or did we just decide to put that on them? Because in general, I think mandatory minimum penalties are not a good idea because they limit our flexibility as a board to make decisions about these things. And so I just wanted to hear more about that.
Sure. Good question. Thank you for asking that. So the mandatory minimum penalties are not part of it. It's a separate statute for chronic violations. If you have three or more, it's a very tightly written law, and I guess I have to admit I had a hand in writing that, but it's coming back to enjoy it now at this end. Most of those violations that you're seeing now are under the old permit. And previous violations that we have some MIGDIN penalties on that. Going forward, I believe under the new permit, as well as how we're working with the marinas to get them in better compliance and get better BMPs and ensure that they, are compliant, I think you're going to start seeing a lot less of those. You know, we had to explain that to Marine Association, you know. I think after the important point, I think that meeting was bringing us together to have that dialogue so that we had a better understanding of the permit going forward, as well as what the law requires and why the prosecution team is doing what they have to do under the law. I think they had a better understanding of that.
Inclusion of mandatory minimum penalties, was that something we had no choice about in writing the new permit?
Yeah, it's an NPDES permit, and so mandatory minimum penalties in the water code apply to NPDES permits.
Any other last-minute questions for the executive officer? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we've lost a board member, but we still have a quorum.
We were going to, Scott was going to have just a real quick update on quarry violations.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
He is Kathy Poole.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson, and I'm playing Kathy Poole this morning. And I'll keep it very brief, just provide you a brief update on our quarterly violations report, and this is for the third quarter of 2016. And I just want to bring a couple items to your attention. You've probably noticed that the city of Barstow is a regular customer on our violations report. This is due to historical discharge practices the resulting groundwater nitrate contamination. Just provide a brief update on them on some recent progress. They're getting ready within the next couple of weeks to get out on their what's called the North Field. So it's on the north side of the Mojave River. Near the soap mine community, and to do some soils analysis. This field historically received biosolids applications, and that continues to be a potential source of ongoing nitrate pollution in the groundwater. So they're doing this soils analysis in preparation of implementing a pilot treatment project where they will be extracting the groundwater, doing a treatment process, and then re-injecting or reapplying it to that north field. So they want to be able to optimize that pilot project, and to do so, they want to know just where the nature of that biosolids layer is within the soil column. So we expect them to get out there within the next 2 weeks. This is good progress. This is good news that they are making some progress out there. It's being done in response to one of the cleanup and abatement orders that we do have on the city. And the other cleanup and abatement order is to provide drinking replacement water for the soap mine residents that have been adversely affected and are on private wells. So that's one thing. The other thing, point out real briefly, you may have noticed the actual violations table, which is on bait stamp 1548. A little different format this time that we're trying out, basically breaking it out by county and then priority violations. So we think rather than just one continuous long list, this will give you, it'll be a little easier to understand and see where it's located, and and maybe not glaze over as you look at the violations in one long list. The other thing that I wanted to point out, see if I can find it. There we go. Just a couple more updates on the monthly enforcement action report, which is bait stamp 1569. Just wanted to bring you up to date on, there's an item down at the bottom of it, Meeks Bay Marina. We had a proposed settlement agreement go out on the streets to resolve some mandatory minimum penalties. Comment period on that proposed settlement closed, and we did not receive any comments, and we're anticipating that will be executed by the executive officer soon. It's in our EO's hands right now, and that will help resolve past violations. And then the other thing is that we are continuing to work with the Forest Service, who is the property owner of that facility, the Meeks Bay Marina, on addressing stormwater runoff issues and permit compliance under the Marina General Permit, both on a short-term basis and on a long-term basis. And so right now that marina has been closed down, and the Forest Service is working collaboratively with us through settlement talks, and we anticipate coming up with a document here relatively soon to memorialize the agreements and set a pathway forward again. So as Ms. Kuyumjin had mentioned on the floodplain and getting things memorialized, agreements going beyond the verbal, we're taking a similar approach on short-term, long-term approach to resolving some longstanding issues we've had with runoff at that facility. So I believe that's good news also, and good progress. And then one final update, and it's also highlighted here in the monthly enforcement report. Water Board staff, the prosecution team, is continuing to meet with the City of Victorville to resolve an ACL complaint that we issued earlier or mid 2016 regarding several sanitary sewer overflows and the city's overall sanitary sewer program that's regulated under the state's sanitary sewer overflow general permit. We're continuing to make progress, working well together in settlement talks on that, and are hopeful to be getting a settlement, proposed settlement agreement out here on the streets in the next month or so, hopefully, somewhere around there. So stay tuned on that. And with that, I think I will sit down unless you have any questions for me.
Kristen? Ms. Cox?
Thank you. I noticed Phoebe DeBerry had an unauthorized treated sewage discharge to the river. When did that occur, and how many gallons was that?
It's actually been quite a while ago, and due to just staffing issues and other priorities, we have not yet been able to get to it. I'm going to say it's probably going close to a year, and I want to say it's in the ballpark of I'm not even going to venture a guess.
Okay. Oh, it's an old discharge.
It's an older discharge. It's nothing recent.
Okay. Perfect.
Which is good.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
You're welcome.
And seeing no other questions coming from the board, thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will move on to our last item, which is item number 16, which is the election of the chair and the vice chair for 2017. A red light, even though. Do I hear a motion?
To make a motion
Thank you. I'd like to make a motion that Vice Chair Pumphrey be nominated as chair for 2017.
Ask that the motion be modified to include recommending that Mr. Don Jardine be our coach, our vice chair.
A motion that Mr. Pumphrey serve as chair and Mr. Jardine as vice chair for 2017. Is this a roll call vote one or is this a voice vote one? Does it matter? Okay, we'll do it that way. Thank you very much. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone against? Hearing none. We have our chair and vice chair for 2017. Congratulations. But before we all jump up, I just want to... I've been thinking about this over the last year. We are the only board who changes our chair and vice chair every year. And so what's become apparent to me over the past year is that it puts us at a disadvantage relative to the State Water Board and the other regional boards. All the other regional boards have their chair and vice chair serving for multiple years at a time. I think the chair, so Terry Young, so on the Bay Area, they had the same guy be the chair for, I think, 18, 20 years, and now they just switched to a new chair. It takes the state board at least half a year to figure out to send notices of, you know, meetings for the chairs to a different person from. So now it's going to take them half a year to figure out that Peter is the chair and not me. So not obligating our current slate of chair and vice chair to anything. I mean, there are pros and cons to the different ways. I mean, I think there's a great advantage to having different people assume the role as chair and vice chair because you get insight into what's happening around the state and at the State Water Board. But we do pay a price for this. So it's just something for board members to think about over the next year and to think what we might want to do down the road. And with that, the January meeting of the Lahontan Water Board is adjourned. Look forward to seeing you all again in March.
I hope that's what he saw.
What are you trying to let us know how it works?
Well, it's funny because Tom Brown is talking to me as I was walking out last night or yesterday.
I tried to send it to the dog.
We've already done that. So we're going to implement it. We've already done that.